Tired of not being able to get a hold of anyone when you have questions about your credit card? With 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yes, you heard that right. You can talk to a human on the Discover customer service team anytime. So the next time you have a question about your credit card, call 1-800-DISCOVER to get the service you deserve. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
We are coming back to Atlanta. Right now. Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.
Ridiculous History is a production of iHeartRadio. Welcome back to the show, Ridiculous Historians. Thank you, as always, so much for tuning in. Let's give a big hand, so long as you're not driving, to our man, the myth, the legend, the one and only super producer, Mr. Max Williams.
Woo. You can give it one hand if you're driving. That's okay. Just for a second. Then go back to 10 and 2. Yeah, Max is our own kind of god of deception here. He's a real Loki-esque figure, a real puckish fellow.
And they called me Ben. You're Noel. And Noel, you and I have been excited about today's episode for quite some time. We love stories about espionage. We love learning these often obscured in the modern day tales of what really happened behind the scenes.
Well, it's so interesting now, especially, I mean, you know, we're living in obviously a different time than the early days of the Cold War, but we're grappling with some very similar paranoia, either around, you know, things like existential threats like climate change, obviously now with Vladimir Putin really kind of puffing his chest out and pushing forward into Ukraine. You know, when that first happened, I think a lot of people were like, well, if he's going to do that, what's he going to do next? Mm-hmm. And then what's he going to do after that? And then what are we, you know, where do we fit into this equation? So, you know, the Cold War was a time where it was hard to trust people because there was just a lot of concern that someone who you might think was your neighbor could actually be, you know, a red spy.
And how apropos that you bring this up, Noel, because you and I have become fascinated recently by a novel called Gods of Deception. And as you know, fellow Ridiculous Historians, we like to go to the source whenever we have questions, whenever we want to learn more. We had, in full disclosure, kicked around off the air a couple of ideas about episodes surrounding a gentleman named Alger Hiss, which will be familiar to some, but maybe not all, of our listeners today. And Noel, you and I had this moment where we looked at each other. We're talking about Alger Hiss. We're talking about Hiss. We're talking about this book. And we were fortunate enough, lucky enough, to join with the author, the historian, the creator of this and many other works, Mr. David Adams Cleveland. David, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Oh, Ben, it's my pleasure.
Now, you have, I don't want to make it awkward. You and I were talking before we started rolling today, and I said, I'm going to try not to fanboy too much, but Noel and I are authors as well. And one thing that has always impressed me is the pursuit of literary fiction. Could you tell us a little bit about what inspired you to create Gods of Deception? And then tell us a little bit about this story, because I hope I'm not the only person who was unaware of this before encountering your work.
No, no, you got me too. I was unaware.
Well, Ben, no, let me just say that the Alger Hiss affair has been something that's been on my radar screen since I was a kid. I can remember years, decades past, Bill Buckley having various guests on Firing Line and arguing about the innocence or guilt of Alger Hiss. It was a huge, huge issue in this country. The trial was 1950, but for 50 years afterwards, it divided the country between those who thought Alger Hiss was an innocent paragon of the New Deal, the State Department. He was president of the Carnegie Endowment, and half the country who thought he was a traitor, who had sat at the right hand of Roosevelt during the Yalta giveaway of Eastern Europe and a lot of other bad things. So this has been going on for quite a while. And in recent decades, in recent years, a lot of new information has come out. And the long and the short of it is that we now know that Hiss was not only guilty, he was guilty of crimes that went far beyond what he was actually charged for in the trial, which was passing State Department documents in the late 1930s to Whitaker Chambers, who was his Soviet military intelligence contact, right? So we now know that that was just the 10% of the iceberg. 90% of it was below the surface. We know that Hiss and his fellow spies in the Treasury Department and the State Department and the White House even, there were 500 of them at least, Stalin's willing agents, working in the 30s and 40s and early 50s to further the goals of the Soviet Union. So there were 500 spies, and a number that still boggles my mind, there were 200,000 members of the American Communist Party in the day. Wow. And they provided the infrastructure, the underground, the background, the support system for the 500 Soviet spies that were instrumental in the stealing of the atom bomb secrets and a lot of other bad things that led to the Korean War and Pearl Harbor. So that's just a starter.
And this is, of course, before the McCarthy hearings. I mean, that was when, you know, it became, you were blacklisted if you were a member, if you were one of those hundreds of thousands of Americans that were a member of the Communist Party. So this is sort of like maybe one of the big trials that led to that kind of witch hunt mentality, or where do you feel like that fits in to this story?
Well, there's no question that the conviction of Alger Hiss for spying was a wake-up call to America. It also happened at the same time that the Soviets tested their first atomic bomb. It was also at the time that the Red Chinese, Mao Zedong, took over China. It was also right before the outbreak of the Korean War. So all of these played into the spy frenzy, the red baiting 1950s. The truth of the matter is that there had been a lot of spies. There were 500 of them that we now know. There were, in fact, 200,000 Americans who had been part of the Communist Party. By the 1950s, most of those members had kind of slunk away and disappeared into the woodwork, and most of the spies had either been had been shown up and so had also disappeared, or had been the few that had been convicted. So by the 1950s, it was kind of a done deal. It was over. The damage had long been done, but they didn't know that in the 1950s. There was still a feeling that the U.S. was under threat. It wasn't as much under threat as it had been, but it was still there. So it was a very ambiguous time.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robay,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken, Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two, Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
One thing that I think is fascinating about Hiss's early life, or his, you know, his trajectory, that is, I think, quite informative here, is that, David, he has all the makings of the ideal asset for a foreign intelligence agency. I mean, this is a guy who was a clerk in the Supreme Court. He was a he was, of course, as you mentioned, involved with State Department, later became a UN official. He was also, I believe, a graduate of Harvard. Is that correct?
And Johns Hopkins, if I'm not mistaken. Not to mention a real smoke show. Real good looking man.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
The interesting thing is that Alger Hiss and a lot of his underground colleagues were all Harvard graduates. There were a lot of them. He wasn't just Hiss.
And that's something I think that might surprise many people unfamiliar with the story, because often in the public sphere, when people think in terms of espionage and spycraft, they think in terms of some kind of deep cover, very ordinary, possible mid-level bureaucrat. They don't necessarily think of people who are at the wheels of the halls of power. Could you tell us a little bit about Hiss's evolution toward becoming a spy? As you said, you know, there was a lot of information that only came out after the fact. Is there a moment in this man's life, or a frame of time, where he encountered some sort of ideology or event that persuaded him?
Turned him.
That turned him.
That's a great question. And the answer is that nobody really knows for sure, because Hiss is unique among the great major spies. If you look, for instance, at the British Cambridge Five, the great spies, Kim Philby, Donald MacLean, Anthony Blunt, John Cairncross, they all fled to the Soviet Union. They all spent their last days at their dachas outside of Moscow. They admitted that they had been spies, and they were under such pressure during the days of their spying, they were traitors to the country, they were traitors to their class, that they were all alcoholics. They literally drank themselves into early graves. So we have a pretty good idea about when they became communists, mostly in their days at Cambridge. And they were active communists and in support of the Soviet Union from day one. We don't know that much about Alger Hiss. He managed to keep his affiliations under wraps. Only Whitaker Chambers, the guy who found him out and who was his spy handler and who was in the trial against Alger Hiss, he was the only person who really knew Alger Hiss when he was reading up on Lenin and in Marxist study groups and that kind of things. So we know that that went on, but we don't know from Alger Hiss or any of his contemporary spies or agent or Communist Party members exactly how that evolution took place. But it was quite clear that for Hiss to get where he got in the highest reaches of the State Department, he couldn't show any of that. If he was caught reading the New Masses magazine or the Communist Manifesto or the works of Lenin, that would have come up in his security clearance. So he was obviously very careful not to display anything like that that would have brought issues in terms of his security clearance. But the amazing thing is that Alger Hiss maintained his innocence literally to his dying day. He went to jail for 4 years. He came out and again, he tried to undo his conviction and tried again and again to appeal his conviction, was unable to do so, but to his dying day, with the greatest equanimity, maintained his total innocence.
And that was a conviction for perjury, which is obviously a big deal, but it's not the same as treason, right?
Well, the conviction was for perjury, about lying about passing top secret State Department papers to Whitaker Chambers. So it amounted to espionage and a traitorous activity, even though they got him on the technical issue of perjury. Yes.
I see. I've always wondered, you know, you talk about these 200,000 Americans that, you know, identified as members of the Communist Party at that time. That doesn't necessarily mean, you know, a complete affiliation with the Soviet Union, or that they were spies, or that they were in some way trying to bring down the government of the United States. I mean, isn't there some of those that just thought it was an interesting philosophy and found, you know, things in it that were functional that maybe they wanted to read about and that they were inspired by?
It's a little bit hard to say, because most of the members of the American Communist Party just faded into the woodwork and didn't admit anything about their past. And most would say that they were idealists. And in fact, the American Communist Party, it has to be said, was in the forefront of trying to get civil rights reform early in the 30s and 40s. They were really in the forefront for calling for Voting Rights Act, end of desegregation, all of that good stuff. So there were a lot of good things that they believed in. But in fact, the Communist Party was in itself a secret organization dedicated to the overthrow of the American government. It was not a democratic party. They believed in revolution. They believed in overthrowing the U.S. government by one way or another. So even though a lot of the fellow travelers, Communist Party members, believed in good things and wanted good things for the country, they nevertheless provided the underground infrastructure, financing, and what have you for the American spies. So they were, you know, they had their side to them that was pretty anodyne, but on the other hand, they also provided the underground for almost all the Soviet spies, and almost all the Soviet spies came out of the American Communist Party.
So is fellow travelers a thing? Like, I've not heard that term used in this context before.
Yeah, fellow travelers is sort of those little bit betwixt and between who are not quite members of the party, but on the other hand, we're kowtowing to most of the party discipline and the party's line in terms of their attitudes towards the Soviet Union and the communist movement around the world. So, I mean, one of Alger Hiss's spy compatriots was Harry Dexter White, who worked in the Treasury Department. Now, Harry Dexter White, among other things, and Whitaker Chambers knew this very well, was never actually a member of the American Communist Party. And if you're a member of the American Communist Party, you are under the discipline of the party, which basically means you're under the discipline of Moscow Central and the Soviet Union and Stalin and his band of brothers, right? So Harry Dexter White was not under the discipline of the Communist Party, but he did some of the more damage in some ways than even an Alger Hiss. Just as a brief example, Harry Dexter White was called into a meeting by his Soviet handler. This was in the summer of 1941. Viktor Pavlov was his name, was the Soviet handler in Washington, D.C. And he asked Harry Dexter White to have a meeting with him at Old Abbott's Grill across the street from the Treasury Department in Washington. And Pavlov says, I'll be carrying a copy of the New Yorker. That's how you'll recognize me. They'd never met in person. They had lunch together at Old Abbott's Grill. And Pavlov, same Pavlov like the dog, you can remember that, pushed a piece of paper across the table to Harry Dexter White and said, I want you to memorize what's on this piece of paper. And Harry Dexter White picked it up and looked at it, read it, nodded, and was about to put it in his coat pocket and said, Pavlov says, no, give it back to me. And he handed it back to Pavlov. And Pavlov said, do you remember everything that's on that piece of paper? And Harry Dexter White said, I do. I remember it, and I will follow the orders explicitly. Well, what was in that piece of paper was known as Operation White, as in Snow White. This was a plan concocted by intelligence agencies of the Soviet Union to get Harry Dexter White to influence the American policy towards Japan at this very precarious moment before Pearl Harbor, when the Japanese had been fighting the Soviet Union for years along the Soviet borders with Mongolia and Manchuria. They had had flare-ups there. Thousands of soldiers had been killed. It was a big deal. It was a war by any shape or form. And so the orders that Harry Dexter Watt got was to put pressure on the Japanese. He was the top guy, one of the highest officials in the Treasury Department, put pressure on them, more sanctions on oil, steel, war materials, rubber of all kinds, ratchet up the pressure. And the idea was that if the U.S. ratcheted up the pressure enough, the Japanese, instead of going west into Siberia, north into Siberia, would go east into the Pacific and would attack the U.S. and go south into Indonesia where the oil was. And Harry Dexter White pushed this policy for many, many months with his colleagues in the State Department and the Treasury. And what happened? They ratcheted up the pressure on the Japanese. Precisely at the time that the U.S. Navy brass was telling Roosevelt, was telling the State Department, do not put pressure on Japan. We are not in a position to fight a war in the Pacific, much less a two-front war, which we expect to be fighting against Germany any day now. Nevertheless, Harry Dexter White pushed this policy. We upped the ante with the Japanese, pushed them, and they made the decision to fight and go south to Pearl Harbor and the Pacific. So there is a specific example of a Soviet spy influencing American policy that literally brought about Pearl Harbor.
Bring a little optimism into your life with The Bright Side, a new kind of daily podcast from Hello Sunshine, hosted by me, Danielle Robey,
and me, Simone Boyce. Every weekday, we're bringing you conversations about culture, the latest trends, inspiration, and so much more.
Thank you for taking the light, and you're going to shine it all over the world, and it makes me really happy.
I never imagined that I would get the chance to carry this honor and help be a part of this legacy.
Listen to The Bright Side on America's number one podcast network, iHeart. Open your free iHeart app and search The Bright Side.
Hello. From Wonder Media Network, I'm Jenny Kaplan, host of Womanica, a daily podcast that introduces you to the fascinating lives of women history has forgotten. This month, we're bringing you the stories of disappearing acts. There's the 17th century fraudster who convinced men she was a German princess, the 1950s folk singer who literally drove off into the sunset and was never heard from again, the First Nations activist whose kidnapping and murder ignited decades of discourse about Indigenous women's disappearances, and the young daughter of a Russian czar whose legendary escape led to even more intrigue and speculation. These stories make us consider what it means to disappear and why a woman might even want to make herself scarce. Listen to Womanica on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yes, and this is something that I am so glad we're discussing today, because the geopolitical circumstances of Japan building up to that great conflict were, I think, for the people in the know, the writing was on the wall. Japan was it was known, it wasn't a secret, Japan was resource poor in several key areas, and they would go, inevitably, one could argue, in one direction or another. And the way that you are describing this this influence, this finger on the scale, right, of this fellow traveler, I believe it's a story that needs to be told more often. And I'd like to return, David, to something that you mentioned that I think is going to catch a lot of our fellow ridiculous historians a bit flat-footed here. So, Alger Hiss, born 1904, doesn't pass away until 1996. As we always say, history is closer than many people would like to think, right? Perhaps Faulkner is right when he says the past isn't even past. But the thing that I really was drawn to is that the story doesn't end when Hiss goes to prison. He gets out of prison, and then people involved in the litigation, right? People involved in the legal proceedings, by one way or another, seem to meet with some abrupt ends. Could you tell us a little bit about Alger Hiss post-conviction, you know, or post-incarceration, excuse me, when he gets out, when he serves his time, and let's see, he's released in 1954, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
So he is released, he's disbarred, he goes on to write his own book, I believe, which is about, like you said, he maintains his innocence. But what was the fallout of this great discovery? You know, at this point, Uncle Sam has no choice but to acknowledge, yes, there is espionage occurring at the highest levels. Were there changes in U.S. policy regarding this? Were there further consequences for Hiss? What happened to some of the people? I'm thinking also specifically of the example of Lawrence Dugan. if I'm pronouncing that correctly, who has a, well, I don't want to poison the well too much here, David, but I believe he falls from a window under questionable circumstances.
That's absolutely right. And this is actually one of the things that my reading of the history and doing my research for the book that I was profoundly amazed at. It was something that was spoken of at the time, but not too many people paid a lot of attention to it. But the fact is that a lot of the people around the Hiss trial, potential witnesses, disappeared in unhappy ways. For instance, you mentioned Lawrence Duggan. Lawrence Duggan was in the State Department with Hiss. He was actually, before Hiss, he was the golden boy of Soviet intelligence. They had a lot of money riding on Lawrence Duggan. They thought that he would prove to be the Hiss in the State Department. But Lawrence Duggan got cold feet after a while. He was a very nervous character. But anyway, Lawrence Duggan would have been called as a witness to the Alger Hiss trial, who had obviously known Alger Hiss and had obviously known Alger Hiss as a communist and as a spy. But Lawrence Duggan never made it. He somehow fell out the 16-story window on 45th Street in New York and fell to his death. They found him in a snowbank, very near death, on his last breath. A Catholic priest came along and gave him the last rites. He had one gumshoe on and one gumshoe off. Very strange thing. And at the time, it was remarked upon. People couldn't understand what had happened. His wife said it wasn't suicide, that he was fine, that he was in good shape. But it was a strange death, but it was also a death by falling, which was a specialty of the KGB. They knew their way around this. And there was yet another witness in the Alger Hiss trial by the name of Marvin Smith, who was a lawyer in the Justice Department. And he somehow fell six stories to his death on an inner stairwell in the Justice Department. He was the man who had signed the transfer document on Hiss's Ford Roadster, which he wanted to contribute to the Communist Party. And he needed to get a legal document signed. And Marvin Smith, who was a friend of Alger Hiss going way back, had been the witness to that signing of that document. That document would have fairly conclusively proved that Hiss was a member of the Communist Party, if not a spy. And Marvin Smith fell to his death. Harry Dexter White, who we just talked about, died mysteriously of a sudden heart attack at his home in New Hampshire just days after testifying about Hiss, denied knowing if Hiss was a Communist Party member, denied being a spy himself. He died suddenly of an overdose of digitalis at his home in New Hampshire. And talk about strange deaths. Alger Hiss, when he was in jail, just before he got out, was in jail with another Soviet spy who had been convicted of spying. William Remington was murdered in Lewisburg Penitentiary when Hiss was in there. And he was bludgeoned to death by a couple of inmates, and nobody had any motive for doing it. It was assumed that they were after something in his cell, maybe to grab cigarettes or money, but it made no sense. Most likely, William Remington had been killed by the KGB, or these guys had been hired by the KGB to murder him as a warning to Alger Hiss that when he got out from prison just 2 weeks later, that he better keep his head down and keep quiet, because what happened to William Remington, what is going to happen to Hiss. So Hiss was under no doubt that he better keep his mouth shut one way or the other. And he maintained his silence throughout the 50s and 60s, right up to his death.
Hold the phone. Hold the phone. No.
Holding it.
We did it again.
This is a banana.
Does someone need to hold something?
I don't know.
Should I hold the phone, guys?
I don't know where that expression comes from, but I like it. I use it.
Like I guess the day of landline phones, nobody's ever really told me to literally hold the phone. But what we mean is...
I think it means putting someone on hold. That's what I think it's. Yeah.
Sorry, that makes so much sense.
But guys, then there's the real question is, where did the phrase being on hold come from? Like, where did that expression come from? Like the holder. I don't know.
You're asking the big questions. We don't have time to dig into that right now because it's been too much time. We actually have to end this episode. What we thought was going to be like kind of a single topic discussion about a book ended up going so many other places with the very fascinating David Adams Cleveland. So we're going to take a pause for this episode, and then we're going to come back with a whole nother episode with David that goes into everything from art history to the current state of geopolitics. And I mean, honestly, I was just kind of blown away by the guy's off-the-dome fact dropping.
And this is, long-time listeners of Ridiculous History or Stuff They Don't Want You to Know, that next conversation is umami for me. We are not blowing smoke. We are big fans of the book and David Cleveland's work. We can't wait for you to check it out. So stay tuned for later this week on Thursday when we'll come with part two of our conversation with David Adams Cleveland on Gods of Deception and much, much more. Thanks as always to Mr. Max Williams. Thanks to Alex Williams. Thanks to Christopher Hasiotis, Jonathan Strickland, aka the Quister. Thanks to let's thank everybody, Noel. Thanks to Beetlejuice. I loved that film.
The star or the fictional character?
Both. You know what? Yeah, both. Friday.
Thanks for making it Friday, the Cosmos.
And thanks to Matt Frederick, of course, because you know, he is the best among us.
He is the best among us, and also the star of our Max with the Facts audio bumper. So thanks for that. And thanks to you, Ridiculous Historians. Y'all are the best. We love you very much with all of our little shriveled hearts. Mm-hmm. Speaking for myself, anyway.
Well, you know, it's time for the end of the episode. Can you do the line?
We'll see you next time, folks. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off. Starts Friday and opens Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
This episode is brought to you by the movie The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, only in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
It's directed by Guy Ritchie, who did The Gentlemen, and produced by Jerry Bruckheimer, who did Top Gun Maverick.
Based on a true story, this action comedy reveals the first ever Special Forces mission executed during World War II.
Starring Henry Cavill and Alan Ritchson, discover how one mission changed history, laying the foundation for modern Black Ops warfare.
The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare is rated R and in theaters April 19th. Get tickets now.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.